Health, Education, and Social Services with reference to the nomination of Roger Indell as Commissioner of the new Department of Corrections. Commissioner, if you'd like to take the chair opposite me, we're pleased to welcome you this afternoon. And on April 26th, I wrote to Commissioner Indell and indicated some of the areas of inquiry. It might be expedient, Commissioner, if you would go through that outline and feel free to make any comments that you care to make to the committee. And after that, I'll open the meeting to questions from the committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make some introductory comments first, if I might. There's been a lot of activity in the media recently. There's been a lot of news articles and so on in the papers and in the television radio commentary that have detailed problems within the Department of Corrections. What I think is forgotten in many of these articles are the strides that Corrections has taken and the accomplishments that we've made, the daily successes that we've had over the period of the last 15 months since I've been responsible for this division, agency, and now department. Article 1, Section 12 of the Alaska Constitution says in part that penal administration should be based on the principle of reformation and upon the need for protecting the public. For a long time, we've all known that corrections needed a major overhaul in order to carry out its constitutional mission. Reformation and protection are equally important by constitutional standards. While it's imperative that Alaskans feel confident that prisoners will remain incarcerated to ensure public safety, we also have to remember that eventually these offenders return to society. And our only real protection is ensuring that proper rehabilitative programs take place and are offered so that prisoners released from custody won't commit further crimes. With this in mind, one of the first acts of the governor was to establish and appoint members to a task force on corrections, a group of experts and laypersons that were brought together to make recommendations on literally correcting corrections. Of the 35 major recommendations made by that task force 15 months ago, 28 have been fully implemented, and 5 partially implemented only a year after receiving the task force report. Corrections desperately needed independent status in order to fulfill its constitutional mission, and that has now been acquired and achieved.
Some of those involved legislative initiatives that need to be done?
Yes, some of them did. In fact, the departmentalization was one of those recommendations.
If you have the opportunity this afternoon to indicate areas where you feel the legislature has not met its own part of the responsibility, please.
I will. And in general, my comments would be very complimentary because I think the legislature has worked very closely with the executive branch in working to solve many of these problems. Since this administration has taken office, appropriation increases to corrections will have exceeded 50% over the previous administration, and that is one good example of how the legislature has worked very hard and very closely with us. We're in the process of completing approximately 500 new and or replacement beds into the system. They've either been brought online or are coming online now. The state's obtained a military site at Wildwood near Kenai that is now an operational prison. Whose bay is being renovated for a minimum security prison. Seward was selected for the new maximum security prison. Construction hopefully could commence this summer. In addition to the Palmer Medium Security Prison is before the legislature, as well as a request for a pretrial facility in the Maxud Valley. In addition to these locations, we've constructed a regional facility in Bethel, which will be open in October, and we are developing a regional facility in Nome, which is basically a replacement facility. In other words, we are responding to the critical overcrowding in Alaska's prisons, and we are building for the future. But the thing that I'd like to emphasize here is building is not enough. It's not the answer to our problem. Although it is a priority currently, we have to take steps to reduce our prisoner population, not merely build beds to meet the increasing demands. Accordingly, we have increased the number of halfway house beds by 100%, an alternative that is less costly than full incarceration. We've also increased probation field service staff and asked the legislature to give us the administrative tools to release inmates earlier if they faithfully observe the rules. We've increased the number of paroles without increasing the risk to the public, and revised our system of classifying prisoners to ensure the truly dangerous are kept in secure settings, while the majority of prisoners have less restrictive custody levels. This eliminates unnecessary construction of expensive secure beds and enhances the rehabilitation of prisoners. Despite a recent escape in Juneau and perhaps an occasional lapse in judgment, such as serving grabbed inmates, we are doing the job and we're doing it very well. would forget all of us that the department has nearly 4,000 Alaskans under some type of supervision, and yet the number of adverse incidents are minuscule by comparison. Corrections is being corrected, and our dedicated professional correctional employees deserve the public support. But with that, I'd like to turn to the specific questions that you asked and address as many of those as possible. The first question had to do with the policy or philosophy of the department regarding the classified service versus appointed or PX positions.
Mr. Chairman, I don't seem to have a copy of those questions.
We'll provide that for you, Senator. Please proceed. We'll make copies.
Very simple in terms of policy or philosophy guiding our hiring, promotion, and so on practices. We have a very simple but essential goal, and that's that we want to obtain the best employees that we can possibly reach. The quality of any organization's services is obviously dependent upon the capabilities of its employees. So we're looking for talent, motivation, people with good moral as well as good morale. We want people who are well-trained and educated in order to improve our effectiveness. We have already changed by increasing and improving the standards for our superintendents. We have, in fact, a generational change taking place in Alaska Corrections right now. We are going from the old guard to new technology. And many of the people who had served the state for 20 years are now retiring or otherwise leaving, and we are putting new, energetic, and very capable people in our management positions. If we don't do that, lawsuits and other liabilities to the state are quite obvious. These people have to be aware of technical details. They have to have the ability to manage. They have to know personnel relations, as well as being able to manage personnel. Superintendents carry out the policy of this administration. And while there's been some controversy over whether these people should be partially exempt as opposed to members of the classified service, there is a strong argument that they perhaps should not be members of the same unions of the people that they supervise. Superintendents would be based, should we decide to go to a partially exempt basis, their appointments would be based upon minimum statutory standards based on correctional experience and background. In effect, and I'm just shorthand, but they would have to have 3 years of experience in corrections programming, including at least 1 year of administrative, managerial, supervisory, or policy development experience. So clearly, we want to set a standard that says that these people are eligible, but it would permit us a great deal more latitude than we presently have within the classified service. Superintendents on the negative side should be removable in an expeditious fashion for improper conduct, such as drunk driving and shoplifting, recent occurrences that we've had experience with. This proposal is supported by the Governor's Office and the Department of Law, as well as our own department, for broader discretion of the Commissioner of Corrections and the latitude to appoint and redeploy superintendents at a time of rapid growth of the inmate population. It does not jeopardize the correctional career ladder. In fact, we can make a strong argument that it enhances it by making it possible for us to identify good, capable people within our organization and move them into these positions. The minimum statutory standards protect against the potential hazards of the political spoil system. That effort was contained in House Bill 209. Two other questions relating to personnel matters. One, actual personnel changes since January 10, 1983 by name and position, and where they were recruited from, either within or without the department, and the opportunities for advancement from within the department for classified personnel who aspire to administrative supervisory jobs. I have those details here. However, they're very extensive, so I thought that I would share with you the summary statistics, and if you'd like the details, we'll be glad to provide those to you. The department was authorized 217 new positions for fiscal year 84. I took office as director of the division on January 10, 1983. So these statistics are the reporting hiring statistics from January of 83 to April of 84, and we considered both new and existing positions. However, we've reported here only positions at or above range 16. There were 83 of these positions affected during the period. So in terms of total statistics, there were 34 intra-department promotions, that is, people from within the department were promoted to higher levels. There were 6 inter-department promotions, 23 totally new hires, 10 lateral transfers, 3, interdepartment voluntary demotions. 2, rehires. I might add, if I go back for a moment, 3 of those people took interdepartment voluntary demotions to come to work for us. 2 of these people were rehires who had once before worked for corrections. 4 were reclassification promotions. And 1 was an intra-department voluntary demotion. And I have much more detailed information here, but clearly the bulk of these people, out of the 83, only 23 were new hires from someplace other than state government, and most of these promotions were from within the department.
Commissioner, at this point, I'll ask my colleagues if they have questions, because I think this is an appropriate place.
Right.
So we can complete the personnel matters. I see my type is called the personal matters.
Yes.
That must have given you a start.
I consider all of these to be personal matters.
Senator Crawfisher, I recognize for
just a quick question, Roger. So you had 23 new hires.
Yes.
How many were actual lasting residents versus outsiders?
There were no outsiders hired for the Department of Corrections in any position.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Endell, one of the things that I've heard a number of complaints about is the excessive use of acting positions, particularly as superintendents and assistant superintendents. It appears that there are acting positions in Commerce, 6th Avenue, Highland Mountain, 3rd Avenue, Wildwood. Why are we using so many existing positions, acting positions, particularly when some of those positions have gone out for merit system hire, there's been a registered call, there's been interviews, and we're still going back to an acting position?
As far as I know, that isn't acting. We have had acting positions. I'll give you an example out here. You know, Bill Houston, the former superintendent, retired. The logical person to replace him was the former assistant superintendent, who acted in his capacity until we called for the registers, made a decision, and actually promoted him, Mike Dindinger. We've done the same thing in other locations. Stan Zabrak, retired, leaving a position open for him. He was removed from his Palmer appointment. We had no choice but to put an acting position person in that position until we could call for the registers and make an actual appointment. And I think if you'll check each of the allegations, if you will, about who's been acting and in what positions, you'll find that there's substantial good reasons for that to have occurred. Secondly, and I would defend this also, that in the positions that we're talking about, management positions of institutions, we want the best people we can find. And in no case have we hired anyone from the registers who was not either among the top 5 on the white male registered or the minority registered, extended registered, including women and minorities. So that gives us 10 people, theoretically, to select from. But in fact, there may be 3 people listed at the number 3 position, so it may move that number up considerably. But there has been no violation of selection processes. There have been extensive acting positions, people in acting positions, mainly so that we could get the best persons selected from the registers as they came available.
Well, just for a specific instance, what's happening? Who's acting in Wildwood? How is that transferred through?
No one. We have a superintendent, Russ Moody, and until last Monday, we had assistant superintendent Gene Sharp, who retired.
Was Gene Sharp just promoted into that position?
Yes, just 60 or so days earlier.
Well, the information that I had was that there was a registered call for that position. There was an acting member of that position. There was a registered call for. People came from various areas all around the state at state expense. I think 14 people interviewed. There was a decision not to hire off the register. It went back to an acting position again. Then it was called for a second time, and Gene Sharp was put in there 6 weeks away from his retirement date, and has since retired, April 28th.
Gene Sharp was among the top 5 on that register and was selected to put in it. It's true that there was an acting assistant superintendent before his selection. The fact that he retired or didn't retire has really very little to do with anything.
Was it known that he was going to retire when he was selected?
I understand that someone in the personnel people in the organization had already known that he had planned, at least tentatively, to retire this person.
You mean they recruited this person off their list to go to campus?
Yes.
Knowledge that he would serve 6 weeks and then leave the system?
I don't know that to be a fact, but in any case, you could not discriminate against him if he had announced to the world that he planned to retire. That's not according to what.
It's not a matter of discrimination. It's a matter of who you choose selectively in hiring off a register, an expanded register, to it's been said by people in corrections that that spot was destined to be Paul Webb's spot, and that that's how it will eventually work out. He's been in and out of an acting position there, and because he wasn't on the register, and there was another opportunity to get on the register, if you could wait 6 weeks, or whoever could wait 6 weeks, that Sharp went up, took the position, was known to be going to retire. Now there's another register, go through the process again. And in the meantime, we've had a change in the qualification for the register, which allows the consideration of parole officer position as well as correctional officer position, so that the criteria for that selection have changed, and maybe he will make the register. That kind of thing is the kind of thing that people are concerned about.
That's quite possible. I understand. I'm sure that any time the selection is made into a promotable position, there's going to be one satisfied person, and all others are probably going to be unhappy. Mr. Webb does not qualify. He's not on the current assistant superintendent's register. He may qualify at some point in the future. If he falls within the top five, he would be selectable, and we would have followed all state regulations, policies, and procedures.
You stated that you have never hired off the top five in the expanded register through that.
I said we don't hire except for the top five.
In the audit by the Department of Administration of hiring, one of their conclusions was there is evidence that the agency has made it a practice to justify hires below the top five based on work experience gained as a non-permanent employee of that agency, which they went on to say was contrary to the policies of the merit system. That was a finding of an audit by Department of Administration. Is that wrong, or what?
I would have to go along with their conclusions. However, they were investigating one case, and they found that the other allegations that were brought forward at your request to be investigated were without foundation. However, in that one case, it was apparent that there was inappropriate action taken.
Well, their statement was there is evidence that the agency has made it a practice to justify hires.
The only way I can answer that, Senator Alford, is it's not my practice. And if that has been a practice, it will be stopped. It has been stopped, in fact, and it will not be continued as long as I'm chief administrator. It doesn't make sense to violate state policies and procedures. Mistakes have been made, and perhaps abuses in the past have taken place. That's no longer acceptable.
How does the structure of corrections work now? I mean, we've transitioned into a department. We now have, I think, 10 or 11 exempt positions that are basically open for hiring any way you want. And then the rest of the positions are in the classification system.
Yes.
The people that are in the exempt positions, how are they selected?
They are selected by the same sort of criteria I mentioned here earlier. I'm looking for the most capable people I can find based on experience, training, motivation, capabilities.
So, I don't know, I think probably the best way to look at that would be, do you have resumes on all those people?
Yes.
How many exempt positions are there? 10?
Yes, roughly.
There's 10 of them. Over all the employees over, I think it was initially range 18 and then range 16 or something.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, was there an instance where, or one or more instances where personnel was recruited from the Criminal Justice Center? And if so, could you detail?
Yes, that's a very interesting question, because no one has been recruited from the Criminal Justice Center, now the School of Justice at the University of Alaska. But it's an interesting question, because the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government met in 1975 and 6 with the University of Alaska and purposely created what was then known as the Justice Center for the desired purpose of preparing students to enter the criminal justice system in Alaska to do research, to conduct training, and to provide public service to the citizens of the state. As you know, I taught there for almost 7 years. And I, in fact, just thinking about this last evening, I can identify approximately 11 former students and or graduates who are now at work in the Department of Corrections, most of whom were here before I was. At least half of the city police departments in Palmer, Kenai, and Kodiak were former students of mine, and many Alaska State Troopers and federal people, as well as the Fish and Wildlife Protection officers. The point I'd like to make is that if the Justice Center was not producing students and justice agencies were not hiring them, we would be going in opposite directions from intent.
The question wasn't designed to be pejorative as to the desirability of bringing people from the Justice Center into government. It was more, perhaps, a product of the recesses of the mind where there was a reported case of someone dislodged who was in the department and for whom way was made with a former student. That was my recollection.
No, I hired no one directly from the university. The one case which the Department of Administration investigated at Senator Halford's request had been a former student of ours. Several years ago, she graduated 2 or 3 years back. I hired her from the Glenwood Halfway House Center in Anchorage as a clerk typist.
Is she a clerk typist today? Or?
No, she's since left the agency as a result of this administrative recommendation, and she's now back at the Glenwood Center. I would hope that eventually she would find her way back onto the state agency.
Senator Moss, did you have any question on this area, Senator
Moss? Yeah, I was curious to know. There was mention about an escape here in Juneau. It seemed like there had been two of them recently rather than just one. Across the street over here, in fact. They had one the other day. And then they had the one that dug out from the house about twice. He got loose. What's been done about correcting those problems?
Yes, sir. Senator, that's a very interesting and unusual case. In fact, the gentleman, Roy Marshall, the escapee who I would have to use the term allegedly at this point because this is before the courts, but allegedly received the assistance of one of our female correctional officers in his escape. He was being brought to court after being captured and escaped in from Department of Public Safety personnel from the courthouse. He was then recaptured and has since been reconfined at the Buck Creek facility. The other escape to which you refer was not in our custody and was not our responsibility. It was also in the hands of some other law enforcement agents.
Well, this particular individual, he had an 11-year term of which before, I believe, had done 11-year employee, is that correct?
I really don't know how much he did.
I guess the point I'm trying to make is that we have people within the system now that that perhaps you'll be going to shaking it down to make sure you got good employees. In other words, will you be cleaning out the corrections department and replacing them with new hires here in the future?
Yes, sir. I appreciate that question. I have those statistics also. I anticipated that might come up. We have, in fact, since I took office, dismissed statewide 14 different employees. I can give you the breakdown if you like. Such things as falsifying an application, withholding information in a police investigation, 7 people failure to complete the probationary period satisfactorily, 1 allowing drugs in the institution, 1 a major breach of security, that having to do with the escape, 1 arriving on duty while intoxicated, another one dishonesty withholding pertinent information related to the escape. That was the same incident. That employee was just terminated. Another one, abandonment of duty for a total of 14. Those dismissals involved 1 institutional instructor, 1 education associate, 7 COIs, and 5 COIIs. We have 2 administrative terminations, 1 for excessive leave without pay, another one for medical reasons. And that included an assistant superintendent and 1 COII. finally, we have 5 resignations in lieu of dismissal. Two for job performance, 2 for convictions, and 1 for drug involvement. And those dismissals involve 1 superintendent, 1 correctional officer 1, 1 correctional officer 2, and 2 correctional officer 3s. So 21 dismissals of various sorts have taken place since I took office.
In other words, Mr. Chairman, that includes some of the business that you had up around the anchored area where you had some goods that belonged to the correction system that had been filtered from,
yes,
from the system. Those are included in that group you're talking about. In other words, it looks like you are doing a pretty good job on that. But I would like to ask you one question that came to my mind, Mr. Chairman, if I can continue. You mentioned 2 different registers a moment ago. It had to do with minority and non-minority. Is there any difference in the prerequisites on those 2 registers there?
I'm afraid I don't know the technical details, but there's a standard register which people are classified to regardless of minority, female, and so on. They're just listed as the test results or score results show up on the computers over here in administration. Then there's what's known as an expanded register, which the EEO people develop, which includes only minorities and women. And the state rules encourage selection as much as possible from the expanded registers, that is, women and minorities. So you can take and affect both registers, the normal register and the expanded register, to make these selections and appointments.
Well, how would you determine, for example, if you had 5 people on the majority, we'll call it perhaps, register, and down about 10 spots down, you would maybe show 5 people that were in the minority. How would you determine, if you had those people down to 10th spot on the overall deal, whether you should select a person off the minority? I guess what I'm asking, Mr. Chairman, is do you have a percentage that you go by?
No, there's no percentage, Senator Ross. What we try to do in that case, what it really allows the state to do is have a larger selection list, a larger selection pool. So, for example, there may be 10 people who are qualified under those rules, and it gives us 10 people to interview to select from the best. They don't necessarily, I'm sure you know this, but test scores or scores on a personnel register don't necessarily reflect the person's real abilities. And it is quite possible that people with lower scores have outstanding potential. And as you know, I think that the state has a policy that it will do everything it can to encourage minority hires.
One other question, Mr. Chairman. Question, I guess I would try to phrase it. What weight does local citizens' concerns carry with you when you're selecting a prison site? I ask this question because it seems to me like I recall Goose Bay, for example, was a lot of opposition to it, and yet you commented a moment ago that you were preparing it for a minimum security site. How does this compare with what the citizens apparently wanted in that area, and what weight do their considerations or concerns carry with you when you're doing those things?
Well, it carries a great deal of weight. We had extensive public hearing process over much of last year and into this.
I think it depends on where it is.
Sure.
Carries a great deal if it's Whittier and not if it's Anderson.
Well, sure. It's a combination of professional judgment and local opinion. I doubt seriously that there's anywhere in this state or elsewhere where all people would concur that, yes, let's build a prison in our city or community. That rarely occurs. So what we were looking for was the best possible combination. We had extensive public hearings. We focused really on 4 sites, Goose Bay, Fire Island, Seward, and Palmer Sutton. And we held public hearings at all of those places, which is not required by law. That was my decision to hold those public hearings. We would go before the business community and the chambers of commerce, who would be extremely supportive. They saw our institutions as being good economic anchors for the future and so on. And then we would talk to the citizens who live in the neighborhoods, and they would generally be opposed. They didn't want the idea of prisons being in their locale. There comes a point, however, for both the legislative and executive branches when you have to make tough decisions. And we decided not to go with a long-term facility at Goose Bay, but we saw an excellent opportunity to go ahead with a minimum security facility.
Commissioner, I think we're moving into an area away from personnel.
Yeah.
Which is fine, Senator Ross. And
I didn't want to get that one out.
I think Commissioner has a prepared statement on the next area, which would be prison design and construction. I have some questions I'd like to put on that, but before I do that, I'll recognize Senator Halford for one more matter on personnel.
Yeah, just back to the to the register. So now, if you explain how the non-minority register works, expanded by minority register, expanded by minority register, you can reach a whole bunch of people on this register. And basically, the personnel rules require that you hire off of that register. Why have we had a continuing series of interviews and then no hire in an acting position? There have been quite a few cases where that's happened. There were 14 people interviewed on the sharp hire, I believe. There were a number of people interviewed in the hire before that. It went back to an acting position a second time, and then it went to a six-week position. It seems that if you can't reach someone that is going to be acting, then the position isn't filled until there's some change and that person can be reached. That's the impression that comes out of it. And I think the employees are probably more upset about the interest that they show in going through the process and the interviews and having no one hired than if they lost in that selection process and somebody else was hired out of those interviews. It's the frustration of having effort and no decision.
Well, Senator Alford, if I might, I find it quite interesting that I have not received any comments from any employees about that practice. Not one.
How many grievances have been filed with the Human Rights Commissioner, APDA, over the hiring practices?
I don't have those statistics with me, and I don't know how many grievances would be related to hiring practices, but that is available. I can get that. I just don't know. It's not been brought to my attention that that's caused an undue problem. I suspect, and that's all I can do at this point, is that there may be some dissatisfied employees, and I would suggest it's a handful of them, who for whatever reason may not have been selected for one of the positions they thought they were eligible for. And so I suspect that there's some dissidence in the ranks.
Yeah. Apparently, Clyde Baxley from the Kenai wrote to the governor with a copy to you. There's also Marilyn Morgan and Logic's got a Human Rights Commission. You responded to her grievance, so there's a lot of grievances out there, and they are on classification matters.
Okay, well, I stand corrected, but I'm not convinced for one thing that we're in error on those grievances. It's easy to file a grievance, it's another thing to win them. I do know of one recent action, which was one as a result of a human rights complaint, and we have put that employee to work. It's an interdepartmental transfer, we've hired her from another department. She is now at work in our Third Avenue institution. And that was a result of one of our superintendents using an interview form, which was prejudicial. It had terms on there about smoking, about whether your spouse, be it male or female, would be bothered by your having to work overtime or late nights or shifts and those sorts of things. That was found to be a discriminatory kind of interview. That's been eliminated, but that employee was successful in that human rights complaint, and we have employed her. So there are some ongoing problems that we've inherited, and clearly we're trying to clean it up.
This one's hard to figure out, and I'm not sure I've figured this out. This is so I'll read the scenario, how these positions changed around, and see if there's some explanation to it. Palmer Superintendent, PCN, that was held by Zabrak, was transferred to Goose Bay. He then resigned. The acting superintendent, Art Smith, became superintendent. Then his PCN was upgraded from assistant superintendent to superintendent. Then Zabrak's old PCN, which was then vacant at Goose Bay, was filled by placing somebody from Anchorage in the Goose Bay position. But the result was that the one position that was upgraded without any interview and any competitive review.
Yes.
Why were they all shifted around? Why wasn't it simply a matter of leaving the PCNs where they were and going to the register for one new person?
It's a complex issue. Part of it has to do with the fact that they had two assistant superintendents at Palmer, and I found that to be unnecessary. One superintendent should be able to manage that institution with one assistant superintendent. So that was part of our rationale. The other part was that I pulled former Superintendent Zabrak off of the line at Palmer. I put Art Schmidt up there to direct the act to take over the institution, but he was officially in the assistant superintendent's rank. That's the one that we upgraded and made Mr. Schmidt a full superintendent. When Zabrak resigned from Goose Bay, that's really another area entirely, but when he resigned from that Goose Bay position, we in fact had Mr. Collins who had also been removed from the institutional line, and we have to put him back on there. We have to put him back as a superintendent.
Well, I realize that you've got two people that you've got a problem with, and I'm not arguing with you on that, but it just seems that, I guess it's the Art Schmidt PCN, if you'd gone to the register for that one, I don't know who would have gotten it, but it seems that it would have been simpler to simply upgrade the PCN and then go to the register, and if he'd been in the expanded register, he would have got it anyway, and people wouldn't have seen this transfer of positions all the way around avoiding the register.
Well, I don't think there's a problem in any case, because Mr. Schmidt was qualified, he was on the list, and so there's really no problem. It's just that we went a different route rather than what you suggested. There were no improprieties there. As I recall, you suggested to me yourself that we need to learn how the personnel system works and use it.
And was Schmidt on the top five of the register?
I believe he was. I don't recall at this point. But he was on the superintendent's register.
Let me move on, and we can come back to this if time permits. Let me move into the area of prison design and construction. And you'll refer to the questions in the letter.
Yes.
We did have concerns about the sole source contracting procedures, and we heard from some architectural groups in that regard, and there was an audit report concerning that. There were two phases involved, as I understand it, and the result has been that you have now received a work product from the firm that was selected, and that product consists, I'm told, of detailed design specifications that you believe would be usable wherever you build new prison facilities. Am I correct?
That's correct.
And incidentally, the Riker from Seward makes the contention that there would have to be an estimated $15 million transmission line for electrical utility purposes to the proposed prison site, which would affect electrical rates of Seward residents. Has that been brought to your attention? Do you know what this
is? I've read the newspaper articles, and I've talked to the city manager of Seward, and I understand that Seward does need to upgrade its electrical capability. That is, it has ample power, but the lines are insufficient to carry that power. So the city of Seward is working now to upgrade their power. That has not only to do with the prison facility, but the port facility and the coal facility that they're developing, as well as the ship lift station that they're developing.
The product that I just referred to, which was these drawings and specifications, are for modular type of prison construction, as I understand it.
Yes, what we have designed is a prototypical housing unit. I believe I had the opportunity to talk to the committee once before about the prototypical design. It doesn't make sense for us to keep reinventing the wheel. A jail cell is standard. So what we came up with was a jail cell design that gets incorporated into a housing unit, which can be used repeatedly, not only in large, high security facilities, but it can be used in rural Alaska. In fact, this is the design that's going into Nome. And the city of Kodiak, which has nothing to do with us at this point, has also looked at our design, and the city council is working now with whomever to implement that same design, which will be shared by the troopers, the Kodiak Police Department, as well as housing approximately 50 prisoners. So it's a very flexible design, and as a matter of professional compliment, we found that three other states are also interested in our design. It's very cost efficient, it's very easy to construct, and we no longer have to continue to reinvent the wheel every time we need to add on or construct a new facility.
Now, are the units or components of the units bought in packages from outside Alaska, or are they built from scratch, so to speak, within the state?
Either way, that's the unique feature, I guess, of this design. We can use slide-in steel cells that are prefabricated. One contractor, or one manufacturer that we've talked to, is interested to the point that he is willing to move his operation to Alaska to fabricate these cells, which, of course, would be good for the job market here in Alaska. There are several manufacturers of these cells, not just one. It's been implied before that this is some sort of sole source thing. It's not the case.
As to future facilities, if you were to build an Anderson 3 years from now, would you solicit proposals from architects, or would you go forward with the design work that has already been bought and paid for?
Well, more than likely, it would be wisest to go with the design that we bought and paid for, and we would ask architects to come in and do those things necessary for the local problem, soil conditions, water, and so on.
And so you would have that product now. Does the existence of this product with the modular design narrow the field of those who would build or do the construction work?
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, it's just exactly the opposite. This is very simple, straightforward construction. And I've been talking about design in steel cells, but the design is incorporated in such a way that you can use standard concrete block, poured-in-place concrete, tilt-up walls, or steel panels, in addition to slide in steel cells. In other words, the state is at a competitive advantage here, and that when the private sector bids, they will have to look at all pricing of all of those options, and so the state will be the one who benefits.
With that in mind, then, is there a phase two at Seward? Supplementing the first phase?
More or less, yes. You referred in your letter to an advertisement recently seen in the newspaper, an RFP, administered by the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. In fact, that process is just now being completed. Ironically, the same firm that we selected for the first phase has been selected unanimously and scored high above the next choice firm selected by the Joint Committee of DOT, DOC, and one outside member.
To do what?
To finish the design for the Seward facility, as was empowered by the legislature in last session.
Well, you say ironically, I think there are people in the architectural community who think that it's not ironic, that it's an almost inevitable consequence. And I'm not asserting this as a proposition of fact, but they argue that the first group designed, produced it.
I don't mean to be facetious, and I certainly don't want to insult the committee here. But clearly, there's one winner in any of these competitive processes, and the others are losers.
I understand.
So what has happened here is that we have followed precisely all the rules and regulations, policies and procedures, the selection process. We have combined with personnel from DLT, our own people, and somebody from the Architectural Design Council, or whatever it's called. They all scored this one firm higher than the others. I don't see how that can be reversed.
Now, what is the source of funds for phase two?
It's a $7.6 million appropriation issued by the legislature last year. Let me see if I can find that here. SLA 83, Chapter 107, page 81, lines 9 and 15, allocated a total of $7.6 million to the Department of Corrections for the purposes of planning and design of the new facilities necessary to address our overcrowding crisis.
And when will phase two of this design be completed, or is it?
I believe it's to be completed approximately October, and construction contracts could then be let in roughly November.
And are there, I know we're dealing with this in Senate Bill 409, but are you awaiting the appropriation of reappropriation funds for the construction phase?
Yes, it is critical that we receive we've revised our fiscal year 85 capital request, and it's approximately $40.2 million. It's absolutely critical that we receive assistance in the fire department.
And the phase now being designed is for how many prisoners?
320 beds, 320 cells. That'd be five housing units, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to go back through this thing, I don't think we really have it figured out. The first round, phase one, was a non-competitive bid.
Yes.
You went to the Department of Administration with a request for a non-competitive bid, and they denied it. Went back to the Department of Administration for a request for a non-competitive bid, and it was approved.
Yes.
At that time, did the Department of Administration have any comments about limitations on the second phase bidding process? Do they have any reservations about using that or make any comments in there?
They said that they would like to reserve the right to eliminate the winner of that phase one, or the awardee, I guess, of that phase one contract. However, they later reversed their position because that would appear to be deleted.
But they were concerned themselves then about awarding a non-competitive first contract and that building itself into a second phase, even if it were competitively, because they were concerned about a potential advantage for the second phase.
Apparently, yes.
Who made the decision on the contractor for the first phase. Who were the people who did that?
Myself, my assistant commissioners, special assistants, a variety of people worked on it.
Didn't you have a board that went through the proposals?
Yes, facilities planners. We had a variety of people who worked on those. In fact, the auditors came through and looked at all that material.
So who were the members of the actual board?
Well, that's easy to get confused here because the first selection process, there was not a formal review of presentations. There was an informal selection process. In fact, there were formal presentations made during this informal process to several people of my staff, the governor's office, other departments, administration, DOT, and so on. These people came up from all over the place and within Alaska and made major full-scale presentations. So there wasn't a formal committee process at that time.
So we had 12 outfits that came and made proposals at their own expense, basically,
yes.
To be considered.
Yes.
And it went to one. And we go on. Phase one was completed in December. And phase two then went out for, again, the same process. Or no, it went out for a full competitive process.
That's right.
Okay, and the process started out with... a number of proposals and then reduced to three proposals that went before a board. Who was on that board? That was the most formal board.
Yes, that was very formal. Let's see, Kevin Bruce, Vicki Williams, my staff,
Barry Jackson?
Yes, Barry Jackson, the Department of Administration.
And what were their qualifications for evaluating a major construction project design?
Barry Jackson had been a principal mover, I guess, of the state office building proposal in Anchorage and has years of experience in contracting, leasing, negotiation, building, and so on. My two people obviously represented the Department of Corrections and our views and have been involved extensively in the design process so that they know full well the kinds of design and the answer solutions that we're looking
for. Are these both exempt positions?
Yes.
Do they have any formal experience at all in design work or anything like that?
I don't think so.
Do you recall what the vote was on accepting that phase two contract? The information that I got was that Barry Jackson voted against it.
All right. As I recall, yes, there were two firms at the top. One was PM&E, the other one TRA Carr. I understand that Mr. Jackson had TRA Carr in first position. The other two people had PM&E in first position.
At the time of phase one, was it anticipated that this sewer facility would have over 700
Yes, that concept evolved. It at the beginning of that phase one, no. We had talked about two separate institutions. In fact, an Anchorage replacement facility and a maximum security facility.
Well, is the design work we paid for a 700-person facility or a 320-bed?
It actually was 320.
So there's no redundancy in the design?
Okay, continuing with phase two, what do you think the cost per proposal to the individuals who made their phase two proposal? I guess you probably don't have any idea. I don't know.
I guess it would be $40,000 to $50,000. That seems to be general cost.
So a number of firms spent quite a bit of money to make proposals
sure.
For phase two.
Sure.
And phase two basically went, I understand the contracting procedures as they work. So you select the top one. And phase two authority negotiate was, let's see. Okay, in January 11th, you notified the Commissioner of Administration that you were going to go ahead and negotiate with the selected firm, which was PM&E, for phase two.
Right.
And you stated that 12 firms were evaluated, 3 finalists were interviewed a second time, and the committee then selected the final firm recommendation. And the contract will next be negotiated and forwarded to the Department of Administration for contract review. That was on January 11th. So the process was basically pretty complete to that point. On January 26th, you announced the cancellation of the second phase of the architectural engineering design work. cited savings and that you would use the basically the building contractor for the final design.
Yes.
What happened? Why did we spend all the money and all the time for individuals to apply for that job? And you approved that it was going forward. And 2 weeks later, the entire process was short-circuited. What happened in the interim?
It's a very complex answer, but to answer this succinctly as I can, the Department of Corrections is totally, almost totally dependent on the actions of three other departments, Department of Transportation, Department of Administration, Department of Law. In this particular case, both the Department of Law and the Department of Administration advised us not to proceed with that committee selection and awarding of the contract and so on. They alleged that there were some improprieties, I guess, in terms of licensing and so on of the PM&E firm. As it turns out, Department of Law has totally and completely reversed that opinion since that action was taken. However, at the time, I was under legal counsel and DOA advice that that was the best step to take.
So what if the Department of Law say anything about the other factors, the process with which PM&E was arrived at? I mean, PM&E was clearly legal to do the job, and I have no questions about that. I agree with your assessment that their initial reaction was an error. But did they also say some other things about the process itself?
Yes, as I recall, they did. And here again, we had some difficulties because we were dependent upon the advice and assistance of the department who normally takes care of those kind of things. They advised us how to go about it, we followed their instructions, and when we were done, they come back and criticize us for not doing it properly, in spite of the fact that we followed their instructions explicitly.
One of the things that I'm concerned about now is phase three, or the new phase two.
Okay.
What's going to happen? Are we going to find that the same group, because of an original non-competitive bid, is in fact tied together and will build the facility?
Well, the same firm has been selected. I understand they're negotiating a contract at the present time, and I would expect them to commence design work on that very soon.
You're the design director, and you're talking about construction.
Oh. But now are they tied together or not?
No, construction is not tied to design, except that they build what is designed. But the design firm will have nothing to do other than probably oversight to make sure that what's being built is what was designed.
But they will play an architect's role, but someone else will do the construction work.
Yes, that's open and competitive. It goes out to the marketplace to see what comes back.
Just along with this, Roger. The firm did phase one. Are there any principals in that firm that are also principals in firms that may end up bidding in the construction?
Not to my knowledge. That's come up several times. And it's possible to write a contract so that they cannot be involved except to oversee that the job is being built as to design. But no, there's, unfortunately, in this business that we're in, rumors have a way of getting started, and they grow and boil and fester, and people add to them, and pretty soon they're accepted as fact. And I found that over the last probably 9 months that I've been involved in the design construction area, that I'm amazed at what goes on in not only the architectural and engineering world, but the construction world. It's a highly competitive industry, if you will, and apparently some folks will go to great lengths to try to cause problems. That's been my experience.
Is PM&E involved at Nome or Goose Bay or any other sites?
No, at Wildwood. They are. They had done the retrofit design of Codes 5 at Wildwood, and they may, in fact, again, supervise the actual construction of what they designed, but they're not involved in construction. Matter of fact, that contract's already been awarded. I don't recall the name of the firm. It's a native corporation who's going to be doing work.
Just, sometimes rumors, it's good that they do it come up because I think it gives a forum to really straighten things out. Let's go back to PM&E. How big is their company? Do you know?
I have
number of employees.
I have some of those documents. I would assume they're probably 50 employees.
Okay. The reason, Mr. Chairman, if I can, it's a rumor, too, that when you do a sole source contract, you're always looking to see what kind of company it is. And I took the time, Mr. Chairman, to visit the company in Anchorage. And I was somewhat appalled because we're talking, if we're basing that original contract, which was not out for competitive bid,
roughly $900,000 in 90 days. We're talking, assuming they work a seven-day work week, $10,000 a day for design work. And my gosh, in Anchorage, I'm sure they don't have a staff. At least what I saw when I went in the office with the secretary, a small board, which might have meant their contract subcontracting. And they may be doing that, but being on a borough assembly, I used to always, when bills were submitted, they would always give you some idea how many hours of engineering time, how many hours of this, and how many hours of that. And being a sole source, I thought this would be available. When I came down to Juneau, they checked on the first two invoices. All the invoices say, like, the first one says 17% complete, and this is the billing. And so I look at it that if we paid them $100 a day, they'd have to have 100 employees to really justify that kind of money. If they worked a five-day work week, now you're up to $14,000. And I just had a hard time in my little mind putting together that size of a company. Now, I know they have a Seattle branch, so maybe that's where all the work went. But I guess I have a real problem, and it's probably not your problem, but in the billing process itself, the stink has no idea whether, in fact, we got our money. Because we can't tie it back to hours, people, other than 17% finished, we need to check $207,000.
Well, I appreciate your concern, but I would be glad to go over to the office and bring back the 14 volumes of material that they produced in 4 months. They did an outstanding job for the state of Alaska.
But can we get a list of man hours and put on a project?
You certainly can.
So that we can have it at least, you know, to see, because I've had people in my area say, hey, how do you substantiate $10,000 a day?
Well, there was approximately $950,000 on phase one design, and phase two, which is also design, what's the price on that?
The estimated price by DOT is, I think, a ceiling of $1.2 million.
So we will have over $2 million in design before we start to break ground in October.
Well, yes, except that, don't forget, the first design was to look at four different institutions and four different pieces of work which they completed. This next phase looks only at Seward.
But what are the four different places? What were the four different places?
Nome, Wildwood, the long-term facility wherever it was to be, and the Anchorage replacement facility wherever it was to be.
But the concept is that they're all interchangeable, more or less, aren't they?
Well, yes, except for the size, and Wildwood is a peculiar situation. That's an existing physical plant.
What do you estimate the cost of the construction at Seward to be for the 320 beds?
Approximately, this is rough, so approximately $34 million.
And how does corrections and DOTPF interface in these projects? What is your area of responsibility and what is their area of responsibility?
We have agreed through a variety of meetings since Commissioner Knapp has come on board that they are responsible for all technical aspects of the task. We are only interested in the design and operational aspects. That is, we must have a design that we can live with for the next 20 to 50 years. So
the construction will be their responsibility.
Absolutely.
Well, now the source of the $34 million is anticipated to be what? I mean, I haven't seen it in any budget yet.
It's in the process of being introduced, but the governor's office is responsible for that as well.
Okay, so I guess I'm getting at is that we're going to have a facility in Seward that will cost $34 million to build. We have spent over $2 million for design. And I appreciate that some of this design may be usable elsewhere. Is there any rule of thumb that relates the cost of the design or the person to the constructive size or scope of the construction?
Yes, I'm afraid I can't recite it, but my understanding is that the state has thus far received a bargain. We have come in far under. I can give you a couple of examples. The design of the Bethel facility, the design cost was approximately $500,000 for a facility costing, I believe, just under $9 million. So the costs of the contracts, in this case with two design phases, is much less than normal.
Are you intending, if you can get it, to pay cash for the trip for a sewer facility, or will this be a lease arrangement, or what is your present?
Originally, we started with a lease concept, and unfortunately, other issues and other programs and efforts and so on of interest to a variety of people also picked up on the leasing thing. And it appears to me that leasing is probably not looked upon favorably by the legislature. obviously this facility would cost from 3 to 4 times more over an extended period, of course, if it were leased. If it were paid for by a direct appropriation, that's a one-time thing, and it's done.
And would all that money be expended in the course of the next fiscal year, or do you know?
It would probably, the estimate is 22 to 24 months of the construction period. So one of the other plans that we had discussed was appropriating half of the money this year and the other half the following legislative session. The difficulty, of course, is anticipating whether following legislators would agree. Another point I'd like to make is that the design that we have come up with here, the cost per cell is approximately half the cost per cell using traditional construction methods. So I think that what I'm faced with is opinion that one, we don't need more cells, and two, there are other priorities. I think it should be made very clear, I'd be irresponsible if I didn't make it very clear, that we are presently having a correctional crisis. And even with all of the steps that we are taking now to divert prisoners, to release them early, to retrofit old military sites, and so on, by the time this facility is built, assuming it will be, our crisis will be expanded.
If I understand this correctly, we're going to, and I let me predicate my question by saying I appreciate the difficulty of your job, and my uncle was once asked, he was city attorney in Trenton, New Jersey, by a student who was coming through to meet government, whether, they said, Mr. Josephson, is your job a political plum? He said, it may be political, but it ain't no plum. I think your job is political, but it ain't no plum. But I find that you're going to be spending almost $200,000 a bed down in Seward, if I'm correct, if I've done my math correctly. If you're going to spend, zero.
Well,
if you're going to be spending, you're going to be building 320 beds for, I think I am wrong, because I used a $60 million figure, but it's going to be $100,000 a jail cell. Does that seem reasonable?
No, we should be able to get that figure between $70,000 and $80,000, and the estimates using other construction methods are much, much higher in Alaska, at least.
Is there any company, Roger, that has modular units that has been making or say putting these up in other states?
Yes, sir.
Could it have been done where those companies could have come in without us doing any design, say for $900,000 or $150,000, whatever, let them put the bid in, not only designing but also building? Would it have been a cheaper way to go since they already have the experience? We're talking modular now, which means you can put them anywhere.
Yeah.
Why not go that route instead of going through the whole?
I'll be quite honest with you, it took me a year to convince the Department of Transportation personnel that modular cells would be acceptable. They were totally opposed to that concept, and it wasn't until the little city of Palmer Police Department put them in and got the criminal justice community, chiefs of police and so on, interested, that they finally came around. So it's taken a great length of time just to get them convinced that they should accept that.
If I may follow Senator Fisher on this, then. Some states can go to a national company that does this on a turnkey basis, has the prefabricated plans, and says, for X dollars, we'll design, construct, and give you the keys to your prison, correct?
That's right.
And so you're not against that procedure, but you found some resistance within the bureaucracy in doing that.
That's correct. In fairness, though, there's another issue, and that is that because these companies are capable of doing it, does not mean that they necessarily produce a design for a long-term high-security facility that would be acceptable. I've seen lots of designs. Some of them are very bad, so it may be cheap, but if we're going to operate it for 20 to 50 years, we also have to have something that we can... You know, the design we come up with is Spartan. The cost in correctional construction is because of the very expensive hardware. Steel doors that slide, and electronics, and control panels, and control gates, and so on. That's the expense. The construction of just posting beam construction and attaching panels is the same as they do on any buildings in Anchorage or Juneau.
What were the considerations that led the department to withdraw from the notion of a 700-plus person facility at Seward to 320 beds?
Very simply, legislative persuasion. I was told by several people that I discussed this with that the price tag would simply be unacceptable. So I was asked to go back and come in with a bottom line, a revised budget, capital budget, and I've done that. We consider this, I think it is $40.2 million, most of which would go to sewer, to be our bottom line.
The $34 million would be just for sewer, or would that include expansion of the other?
So that's just for sewer. The remaining $5, $6 million, whatever that is, would be that spread out at several institutions.
I'm going to ask a stupid question. Is there anywhere in the lower 48 where, let's say, prisons are contracted out to a for-profit corporation as far as the building and running them? Have you looked at that at all?
There's a recent article about that in the state government news.
It's not being a stupid question. Have you analyzed that versus this expense?
Yes, we have some interest in that. We have some people who've written and called and so on and made proposals. Generally, those people are not experienced, I guess we use this term, in prison construction. They are willing to, I hope I'm not underestimating them, but throw together a prison facility and build it on your site at low cost. And I'm not convinced that that's a safe thing to do. On the other extreme, we have some states where prisoners build the prisons themselves. I'm not proposing that, but that's the other extreme.
Well, the article I read indicated that there are pros and cons. There are some economies to get away from some of the rigidities of state union problems, personnel, fringe benefit, civil service problems. On the other hand, it is harder to monitor conditions and the adequacy of food and other social objectives, rehabilitation you mentioned.
That's right. I think a critical difference also, Mr. Chairman, is that it's very easy for all of us to just count the number of beds and then count the number of inmates, and even with some projections, just balance beds against heads, if you will. But it's much more complex than that because we have several types of prisoners, male and female, obviously, but we have felons and misdemeanors, we have pretrial and sentenced people. But in fact, 85% of our prisoner population are felons. 66% of those people are serving between 5 and 15 years as a result of modifications to the criminal code and so on recently. So we have a very large, long-term prisoner population. And we have purchased at very low cost two former military sites, and we're developing those. But clearly, there's just no substitute any longer for a long-term high security facility.
Chairman, just one real quick comment. Roger, is there any truth to the idea that we're over-classifying prisoners, and that's why we have the problem? And to be on the safe side, you'd rather go for the maximum security classification so that you avoid the kind of things that maybe happen to your juvenile prison. Isn't that a safest thing?
No, as a matter of fact, we've revamped totally our entire classification process. And I don't know how well aware people are of my history, but I have testified before the legislature for several years in opposition to constructing a maximum security prison in Alaska. I think the record would show I've been consistently opposed. I am convinced that there's no longer that alternative. We must have one. We have 1,000 more prisoners today than we had in 1980. We have 300 prisoners more today than we had 1 year ago. And they will increase at 300 a year from now on, unless we do some very serious modifications to the system, to the law, and so on. But I see no substitute for building this one facility.
You know, capital punishment.
Sure. Just like trying to figure out what happens phase one, phase two, phase three. What's the difference in phase three of the PM&E contract with phase two of the contract that was canceled?
Well, it was managed by the Department of Transportation instead of us. That's probably the major difference.
You would have gone forward with phase two. Had already given the go-ahead on phase two.
Yes.
And it was canceled because of legal problems.
Well, alleged, because they were obviously reversed later.
But it was at the request of the Department of Law.
Yes.
And then phase three went through and did the whole thing again.
Yes.
But the same contracting firm still won.
Yes. They've in effect won three times.
So basically, well, the first time it was non-competitive.
True.
With a negative vote by the one person that has the design experience.
No, that was the second time.
That's me right, the second time, excuse me.
The first time it was non-competitive. The second time it was three people made the final selection on a 2-1 decision. And the third time was done by DOT. Well, what was the reason? So that the only reason for canceling phase two was then to avoid the potential legal liability in court cases that were apparently going to come out or at least the Department of Law was worried about potential court cases challenging the award of phase two. So by going back and making it phase three, the case is moved.
Phase three has nothing to do with phase two. In fact, it was the Department of Law's mistake, their error, which they have reversed, and that's available if you'd like to see that.
Well, but the scope of the second contract is exactly the same as what you were talking about in phase two, right?
I believe so, yes.
So they didn't change the scope, but
I think that's correct.
But phase three is referred to as design-build. That's the one thing that I can understand. It's been referred to you as that by you in newspaper articles. I can't understand what happened there. If it truly is just a design contract and can't be expanded to build, I mean, can that contract be amended to go ahead and build, or what does design build mean in the terms of that contract?
Now, as far as I know, the Department of Transportation advertised that as a design contract. Now, it could be an error, but I don't know. I see no reason. First of all, this is not a construction company. It has no construction capability. It is merely an architectural engineering firm.
Well, and that's not what their resume package says. They build all kinds of things. I'm not concerned about the PM&E with regard to the qualifications and licensing and those questions. I think they may have been caught in the internal squeeze between DOT and corrections and who gets the authority to do something. That's not a concern. But the Anchorage Times on the 27th had an article. Basically, the byline is builder to also design a new prison. Corrections officials say the approach will be quicker and faster than having a separate firm do the architectural work. It also makes moot a complaint by the two firms which complained they weren't allowed to bid on a $2 million contract awarded to PM&E.
What's the date of that?
That's the 27th. That's the day after the cancellation of
January. Yes.
That's the day after the cancellation of the Phase 2 contract that's been going online until then.
Yes. We've not proceeded in that direction, however. The new contract or request for proposals put out by the Department of Transportation was going to sign it. See, here again, Senator, we're at the mercy of other departments. We want to work with them closely, carefully, and so on, but it's a little difficult. All we want is a prison built to our specifications.
Who in DOT, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Who in DOT handled this? What specific section did? It's very interesting to me because I will have the commissioner of DOT before me Monday morning at 8:30. I'd like to ask him that question about this specific thing, see what his response is.
Best of my knowledge, that the central section of Anchorage people would have had their planning unit, but I really don't know the specifics.
Thank you, sir.
Maybe I'm losing track of what phase three is. Phase three is the actual construction. Correct?
Yes.
But to do the actual construction, you need some architectural firm to guide it, right?
Well, yeah, they have to design it.
Okay, they have to design it. So if I can just go back to the borough, for example, which is my background, what we found is when we buy, quote, a plan from an architect, they'll say, now we own hot dogs, we can save money the next time using this as a prototype, et cetera, et cetera. But what we found was that when you get an architect number two, he says, I'm not going to be bound by architect number one, therefore, I'll give you a reduced rate. Instead of 8% or whatever it is, we'll go 5%. Is it going to be the same thing here where the new architect coming in is going to say, I don't care what you had designing before, I still got to be satisfied that So I guess I have a problem with phase three. I have a problem with sole source contracts to begin with. And I had requested the Department of Administration, for example, to give me a list of all sole source contractors. They can't do it. Apparently they can't do it. So I guess that's what I'm griping at, that we got locked in phase one to something that's going to eliminate competition in phase three. So, is that
right? Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just going back to the audit report, it seemed that you've gone through 83 and the feeling of the audit report was that you decided on one particular firm offered the best concept for the type of services you wanted. And then once you began developing a working relationship with that firm, you felt it would be hypocritical and unfair to go through an open solicitation for design services. That's a direct quote out of the audit. Then, in going back to your request to the Department of Administration for the authority to go single source, it appears that all the way back in August, you felt that your decision was really made even then, because you stated that I have no desire to be faced with a process of resolicitation, which at this point would only have the result of making our actions seem hypocritical if we were to reselect Pacific Management and Engineering.
That's correct.
Which is exactly what DOT did on the design phase, because it's already gone so far down that road. And what we're still concerned may happen in the build phase, if in fact design and build aren't together. But I'm concerned about the terminology design and build, because we often see major contract amendments that seem to just carry forward forever.
Senator, if you don't mind my saying so, the instructions are that we have to go to certain other departments to get permission to do things. We did that, we got that permission, and we proceeded. Now, are you saying that we have done something in error?
Well, the first thing is that the Department of Administration does not evaluate your emergency. They only say what to do once you determine that the emergency exists. They may make comment on it, but they don't evaluate that.
Well, we have to seek an authority to negotiate. They're the only firm or agency that can give that. They gave it to us.
Right. They gave that to you on your second request, which
yes.
Reads pretty much like the first request.
Yes. But after that was expanded with much more information, which is really why they sent it back. They didn't have sufficient information, so we gave it.
So it is a certification by your department in terms of emergency, not
yes.
by the Department of Administration. The
yes.
emergency is the basis on which the sole source contract is granted.
Yes. But again, I have trouble here because I guess I'm wanting to know, have we done something improper?
Well,
because that's key to
the I think the legislative audit strongly says yes.
No, they have not said that the Department of Corrections did anything improper.
Well, I read the audit to say that in the first request, which said that PMD was uniquely qualified, at least impliedly, the auditor says that the department correctly found that that was not true because there were admittedly a quantity of people who were qualified who wanted to do the design work. Then the department went back and resubmitted its application on the basis of an emergency existing, which was the shortfall of bed space for the increasing prison population. At that point, the department said, yes, we concur and grant you the right to negotiate. As to that issue, the auditor says that the emergency that is contemplated by statute is not this kind of emergency. I read it to mean an emergency for the purpose of allowing sole source contracting meant a flood or an earthquake or fire or natural disaster, not an historic political policy of the legislature and the executive, which led to too many prisoners and too few beds accumulating over a period of time, series of political judgments. Now, whether that is a criticism of the Department of Administration or the Department of Corrections or both, it's arguable. Maybe the auditor is wrong, in fact. But that is his, that was the conclusion.
Yes, Chairman. As I remember reading the conclusion of the audit, it was that the Department of Administration should not have granted the authority the second time around.
Yes.
That they should have stuck with their first decision. So that I think the commissioner is right from the standpoint of his department. There was nothing illegal. I believe, though, that
possible inference that since the Department of Administration rejected the first request for a sole source contract and accepted the second request, that perhaps the governor or one of his assistants, either on their own motion or on your motion, told the Department of Administration, this is a priority with the administration, with this administration, and you will grant Roger's request.
I think that's extremely interesting situation, but I know absolutely nothing that even hints of that happening.
No, that's funny. Because they said no once, and they said yes the second time. My question was very simply, have you contacted the director?
I didn't understand.
Yeah. Because it's normally bureaucratic process from one to the other. But, you know, the administration all works as a team. And when there are problems between agencies, generally it goes to the commissioner level, and that's where they're handled. And if that's not the case, then that's not the case.